up until the 1970s, Marxism was regarded as being a communist idea, not a good idea, just bad stuff. There were very few American philosophers or social scientists who had any respect for Marx. I would say that both Western Marxism, European Marxism, but also the analytic Marxism, which I'll be talking about in this series of lectures, that they are each what you might call intellectual and political positions. They're intellectual in the sense that very good thinking, very rigorous, focused thinking was done about the premises of Marxism as an analysis of modern society. But it was, so that's the intellectual part. There was real intellectual rigor, a real desire to have as good a critical perspective on Marxist theory as it was possible to have. The political side was that there were intellectuals in Western Europe and also in the United States who were very concerned about, internationally, the war in Vietnam. So I think what led to the resurgence of interest in Marxism in the United States was the war in Vietnam in the 1960s. And then domestically, there was a new interest in poverty and inequalities in the United States. The realization that American capitalism, well, in the 1950s, social scientists, I think generally in the United States, took the view capitalism was bringing all good things to the United States, that poverty was going away, that everyone was becoming middle class, that things were good in the land of capitalism. By the 1960s, there was a real recurrence of realization that poverty was not disappearing in the United States, that inequalities were not diminishing in the United States, that opportunities for working people were not getting dramatically better in the United States. So there was a new interest in having a theoretical framework in terms of which to understand and possibly to change. There were very few American social scientists and philosophers who were socialists, let alone communists. Communism was a very tiny, tiny piece of politics in the United States, almost not even measurable. But there was quite a lot of thinking along the lines of what you might call radical social democracy. Radical in the sense of saying the current arrangements are not good arrangements, and then social democracy in the sense of saying society as a whole must be democratic and must provide social support for the less well-off in society. That's how I would define social democracy. And I think it was that kind of intellectual framework and political framework which led to the reoccurrence of an interest in Marxism. That interest was not driven by political party. It was not an intellectual orthodoxy. In fact, there was a huge amount of internal kind of debate and discussion and criticism among the people who were interested in talking about Marxism. But it was aimed at developing a more adequate way of understanding modern society and also of offering critique of modern society. And this, I think, is highly relevant today, as it was in the 1970s in the United States, highly relevant in China. Because the big social forces which are at work, whether it's privatization of industry, possibly privatization of the financial system and the banking system, though I know that that's not on the agenda at the moment, but these massive changes of the economy and the basic social relations of China, these are difficult to understand, and they have very great consequences for all people in China, both rich people and poor people in China. And so just having a better theory, a better understanding of how these social relations work is an important thing. I would say that Western Marxism and analytic Marxism generally was linked to progressive parties of the left, but again, not a very ideological commitment. They were social democratic parties. What's the big idea in analytic Marxism? I would say that it is the idea of reading Marx freshly. The communist parties of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Communist Party did not read Marx critically or freshly. What analytic Marxists have tried to do is to look at Marx as being a very gifted observer and critic of modern capitalism, but not as a super genius, not as a person who understands everything and who has one unified theory that explains everything. They do not regard Das Kapital as Das Bible. I'm making a little language joke here. Did not read Marxism as being a sacred text, but rather read it as a series of kind of eclectic understandings and criticisms and philosophical jokes. It's a big body of literature, and it's not one unified theory. So the idea is, let's read Marxism, Marx's writings, not as Marxism, but rather as a series of insights into contemporary society. And certainly, we cannot assume that Marx's theories are all consistent and all flow from one unified perspective. We can't assume that because they don't. And I think that's evident by a careful reading of Marx's writings freshly. In particular, I would advocate for reading Capital, Marx's economic book, and it's a massive book. The first volume is probably 600 pages. That's the only volume that was published in Marx's life. But read it as sociology, read it as philosophy, read it as institutional analysis. Do not assume that it flows all from one single integrated theory. Likewise, historical materialism. Surely, historical materialism is one of the most important contributions of Marxism. It's not just Marxism. There are other people who are materialist thinkers who are not Marxist thinkers. But the idea of approaching social analysis from the point of view of material conditions, this is a pretty important insight, but let's rethink it. Let's think about it again freshly. Marx offered some observations about the development of history. He talks about classical slavery. He talks about feudalism. But he certainly does not offer a systematic, unified theory of history. And if you thought that he did and then tried to reconstruct one, I think you'd be going down the road of error. Because what's, I think, most valuable is not finding one unified theory from a Marxist point of view. It's rather seeing many different kinds of insights and critiques. We're out of control here a little bit. So Marxist thought, this is kind of an overview, it's kind of a map of Marx's thinking, but there is the early writings of Marx, his humanism and his theory of alienation. And especially in the 1960s, many American philosophers, social thinkers, were very interested in the theory of alienation as being a theory of what a good human life should be, and then a critique of existing social relations along the lines of saying they are alienating, they interfere with the full development of the human being. Second major area, major topic of Marx is the theory of historical materialism, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more fully. It's also important to have some idea of what Marx's intellectual predecessors are. There's German philosophy, Hegel and the followers of Hegel, the philosopher Feuerbach. You've read some Marx, you've read the 10 theses on Feuerbach. Well, Feuerbach is a philosopher who wrote in the 1830s, 40s, I think, within the context of Hegel's philosophy. But then secondly, there's French socialism, French socialist writings, which developed during and after the French Revolution. And then thirdly, Marx, as we all know, was deeply influenced and deeply involved in English political economy, the writings of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and other political economists. Almost, I don't know, many of Marx's works are titled or subtitled A Critique of Political Economy. There's the contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. Capital is subtitled something like Critique of Political Economy. Marx regards himself as learning from the political economy of the English economists, but also critiquing and challenging their underlying assumptions. I would say that Marx's mature writings represent a social science study of capitalism, and then also just a really brief conception of what a socialist order might look like. The historical context is, to me, a really important foundation of understanding Marxism, but it's very relevant to the situation of China today, because Europe and England in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s was in a process of really huge change. Social change, economic change, rural to urban change, industrial revolution, the transformation of rural people into industrial workers in just one generation. This was a period of change which was deeply revolutionary and deeply difficult to understand. People who lived through those changes just had no vocabulary whatsoever in terms of which to express. You know, one generation, there's a quiet babbling brook with nature and bird songs, and 20 years later, there's a huge factory belching smoke, making loud noises, bells and whistles regimenting people's activity. This transformation from rural life to industrial organized manufacturing life was deeply challenging just to understand, let alone to, to criticize. So that's one great revolution. The French Revolution was, as maybe for China the Chinese Revolution is, but the French Revolution was a huge intellectual and political bell rung in the minds of Europe. It was violent. It was perplexing with all of these phases of the left overthrowing the left, the right overthrowing the left, and people getting whacked. The invention of the merciful invention of the guillotine. You know the guillotine? The guillotine is the knife that was used to behead people during the revolution. All of this was baffling, but the political values were also in some ways exciting. The rights of man, the idea of freedom, the idea of equality, the French phrase equality, fraternity, and liberty. These ideas were very powerful ideas and had, again, Marx was immersed in the aftermath of the French Revolution. Industrial Revolution, in other words, rapid change. I'll just say a word or two about the theory of alienation, which comes in Marx's earliest writings and is a reflection on his kind of intellectual relationship to Hegel and also to the thought and ideas of the Enlightenment. But what's really interesting about the theory of alienation, other philosophers put forward theories of human nature. Man is good, man is just, man is by nature this and that. Marx didn't put forward such an idea. Instead, he put forward a critique of capitalism as being a form in which human beings are alienated from various things. They are separated from the process of production, from the product of production. They are made poor. So they create great wealth, but they are separated from wealth by the system of production. That is, they are alienated from the product of production. What that means really is they were simply unable, on the basis of their wage, to buy most of the goods that they were producing. But they were also alienated from their own freedom, because they were in factories which had bells and overseers and rules which said, if you talk to another worker in the factory, you will be fined by, a dollar. If you bring reading material to work, you will be fined. If you show up late for work, you will be fined. In other words, a real regimentation of activity and of labor, of the conditions of labor, and Marx describes that as alienation from human freedom. What I find interesting about the theory of alienation is that you could look at it as a photographic negative. It's portraying what is wrong with the capitalist order. Turn the colors in reverse, it is also a statement of what is a good form of development for human beings. So man is free, social, self-creating producer. That is a very powerful theory of human nature and human well-being. Man is a free, self-directing, social producer of good things. Very powerful conception of what good human life is. Some people have made the point that Marx has kind of what you might call an artistic conception of human nature. An ideal might be the sculptor who works with his hands and his head to transform a piece of marble into a beautiful representation of something, or of an artist who begins with the material, canvas, and the paint, and using his intelligence and his skills and his free expression of himself, creates a work of art. Well, Marx believed that labor has that capacity, that human intelligent labor has the capacity of creating great great works, but within capitalism, the worker is separated from that capacity for free self-expression. I've already referred to the four forms of alienation. Marx also believes that alienation and property are related, or alienation and the division of labor are related. The commodification, he talks always about commodification and the fetishism of commodities, the idea that in earlier social orders, things were produced in order to be consumed, but in capitalism, things are produced in order to be exchanged. But then even further than that, things are produced in order to be exchanged, in order to create surplus value. So production for the purpose of profit. In other words, he's got a kind of an analysis of how the modern social order, the capitalist order, works by way of producing, regimenting labor, marshaling property, and bringing property into the hands of the minority class, and then producing for profits. Control and domination is just an absolutely essential part of Marx's analysis. He believes that capitalism is a social order which depends upon exercise of power over the free activities of human beings. And so domination, control, these are, in Marx's reading, essential to the workings of capitalism. Now, we can turn that theory of alienation into a positive theory. It is a theory that emphasizes the importance of freedom and of human self-expression. It is a good thing for me to be able to express my ideas freely. It is a bad thing for me to be constrained by the university administration, by the state, by my local political officer, to be constrained from my ability to express myself. He's got an interesting theory of labor. Labor as self-creation, the ability of the individual to take intelligence and talent and physical skill and turn those human capacities into useful and beautiful objects. So it's a process of self-realization through free, productive, social labor. The social part of it is important, of course, because Marx makes the point that human productivity is almost always a group product. Even farming, that any kind of complex activity requires social cooperation. And so the wealth that is created is really a social product. It's not an individual product. Let's turn now to analytic Marxism, which refers to specifically to the philosophers and some political scientists and economists in the 1970s who began taking very seriously the insights of Marxism, but did it from a philosopher point of view and a methodological point of view. It was an intellectually open-minded movement puts it kind of wrong. It was just a group of writers who were kind of writing for each other and trying to come to a better understanding of the premises of Marxism. It depended on criticizing, analyzing, and developing some of the basics of the insights that can be found in Marx. One of the big ideas which the analytical Marxists came to was what I would refer to as rational choice Marxism. It's a funny combination because what rational choice Marxism asserts is that Marx's economic writings are often described as being anti-economic, anti-rational choice, but in fact what we alleged and I would put myself in the same category, what we alleged is that Marx's basic social theories are actually premised on the assumption of individual rationality. The rationality of the capitalist owner of a firm, but also the rationality of the peasant, of the worker, that his social explanations are couched in terms of the institutional setting and the rational choices, the rational strategies, which are pursued by the various players. Now, if the institutions were entirely level, then rational choice plus level institutions equals real democracy, you might say. Unfortunately, Marx believes that the institutions of capitalism are not level, that the position of the capitalist, the position of the landowner, the position of the peasant, and the position of the worker, those positions come with very different opportunities and powers. So the strategies available to the worker and the strategies available to the capitalist are quite different. That's an interesting point. You might say the worker has no choices, so why would you even talk about rational choice? But it turns out, actually, this is a place where Western thinking has really done a very good job, a very deep job, of recognizing that even the powerless are not literally powerless. They are not literally without option. Peasants and peasant communities do have forms of everyday resistance, for example. When the state says, bring us another 100 units of grain as your tax, the peasant community is capable of resisting in a lot of different ways. And in fact, we're going to talk about everyday forms of peasant resistance in a couple of lectures. But the point is, all of the players have options. They're not equally attractive options, but they do lead to a strategic interaction between worker, peasant, landlord, state official, capitalist, and the like. And I put it forward in The Scientific Marx, my book, The Scientific Marx, that Marx's explanations, the central contribution that Marx makes is to identify the central institutions of capitalism, and then he works through what are the rational strategies which the agents within that system would best pursue. And then finally, he provides what I call aggregative explanations, which go from those individual level strategies up to the overall social consequences. A really excellent example is the argument that Marx makes for the increasing level of technology within the capitalist enterprise. And there's a kind of a side theorem here, which is the tendency for the rate of profit to fall. But let's just talk about technology for a second. Traditional societies are not very technologically innovative. You don't find rapid technological change. You do find that in capitalism. You find primitive sewing machines being replaced by more complicated sewing machines, being replaced by high-tech computer-controlled sewing machines. So why is that? Well, Marx believes that it emerges directly from the individual circumstances of the owners of sewing enterprises, of firms that make, you know, clothing, let's say. Each of them has one interest, and that is to maximize the rate of profit in the factory. And he has two or three or four different strategies that he could use. One strategy is just to work the workers harder. Sweatshops, in other words, extend the working day, make people work faster, reduce their breaks. So we're looking at our class here as a sweatshop, actually. Keep you working hard, give you very short breaks. So that's one possibility, sweating labor. But there's a limit. You can only work people a maximum of 20 hours a day. and you can only push the wage so low. So a second option is to increase the productivity of the labor process. How can you do that? Well, there are a couple of possibilities. Increase skills is one, so create universities and make workers more skilled. But another possibility is to introduce more technology and better technology. And so Marx now finds every firm owner has a rational and permanent incentive to find more productive technologies. So now suddenly the capitalist is out there beating the bushes, going to colleges of engineering, going to smart craftsmen, figuring out those more productive ways of making shoes and clothing and so forth, and then introducing those innovations into the process. The aggregate consequence is a rising level of technology in manufacturing, There's another consequence, too, which Marx thinks is it's really beautifully ironic. It is that the rate of profit will tend to fall. Because in Marx's economic theory, profits are created by the proportion of living labor. But as more and more machinery is used, there's less and less living labor, and therefore the rate of profit necessarily falls. Well, whether it's true or not, it's an interesting result of his analysis of the institutions of capitalism. There is a tendency towards rising use of technology and also a tendency towards what really induces crisis, and that is a falling rate of profit. Some of the leading contributors here, you've got them in your notes, I won't name them, but it's quite essential, quite basic to the philosophy of social science that I'll be presenting in these couple of days. So it's not an accident that we're talking about analytical Marxism, talking about philosophy of social science, that one of the central ideas that I advocate in my philosophy of social science is the need for micro foundations. That social laws, social patterns, social mechanisms require micro foundations. We need to be able to say at the level of the individual, in concrete circumstances, how it is that the individual is brought to behave in such a way that the macro or aggregate pattern emerges. Well, you come to that conclusion through this analysis of Marxism. Another important line of thought within Marxism is the role of, and this actually was one of the first topics that philosophers in the 1970s got interested in, what is Marx's theory of justice? It's a similar thing to the alienation thing. He doesn't talk about justice. Instead, he talks about exploitation, that capitalism is a system of exploitation. But exploitation and justice seem to be linked. And so can we take his theory of exploitation and then discover what the underlying theory of social justice is? Well, that was a very important subject of philosophers' discussion in the 1970s. Does Marx believe that capitalism is unjust? Well, Marx often says explicitly, capitalism is not unjust. Capitalism is perfectly just, but it's exploitative. Well, that seems to say exploitation and justice are not incompatible, but the philosophers have tried to make sense of that. A third big area is the theory of history that Marx has. And again, one of the first pieces of good philosophy that was done from an analytic Marxist point of view was a book by Gerald Cohen, an English philosopher. And the book was called Karl Marx's Theory of History. Here's the important qualifier, a defense. Karl Marx's Theory of History, a defense. What's interesting about that is that in the 1950s, if Western philosophers looked at Marx's theory of history, they would have said Karl Marx's theory of history, a tremendous garbage dump, a terrible place, forget about it, not important, not interesting. Gerald Cohen changed the terms of the debate by saying Karl Marx's theory, worth defending. And so there was quite a lot of analysis. He provided analysis, and then there was what you might call a program of research trying to take Marx's theory and make good sense of it and figure out what are the big conceptual topics and how can we understand those better. But the basic ideas are, first of all, the idea of class conflict, that history proceeds through class conflict. That's one of Marx's central theories. We're going to have a whole lecture on this in a day or two. Secondly, maybe related to class conflict and maybe not, the idea that there is tension between the forces and relations of production. And there's a beautiful passage that you'll be reading because it's quoted in the chapter from my book that you will be reading, where Marx talks about the forces of production tend to expand, the relations of production first facilitate the expanding of the forces of production, but then they become fetters on the forces of production. The forces of production continue to expand, they burst asunder the relations of production, and then a great period of social revolution has begun. So it's a very compressed theory. But it's a powerful conceptual theory. It's basically saying human beings create the forces of production, That's technology and labor skills and machines and tools. The exploitation of material resources. Human beings also create the relations of production, which are the property relations and the state relations, through which coordination and control of the forces of production occur. The relations of production are a human product, and they are both facilitating and also impeding of further social progress. And then he argues that there are material reasons why the relations of production are burst asunder. Well, it's an interesting theory. It's one that's really worth diving into, and I believe it has quite a lot of fruitfulness. Probably more important than, well, in my mind, more important than Marx's theory of historical materialism is the approach to the social sciences, which Marx constructs. He doesn't define this approach. Rather, you have to read his writings and kind of figure out his approach to the social sciences, beginning with Das Kapital. So what I would assert is that in Capital, in Marx's book, Capital, you find what is really a classic of sociology. It is a classic which is kind of defining a new discipline. And it's also not a single unified theory. I already expressed that a little bit earlier. But it is a collection of insights and perspectives, sociological perspectives, historical perspectives, economic perspectives, on this one central question. What is the modern system of production? How does it work? What is its dynamic of development? And I would say the things that I have learned from reading Marx, this is what I believe comes out of a reading of Marx. First of all, be empirical. And this is advice for 19th century observers. I would say it's also advice for Chinese social scientists. So be empirical. Study the best available sources on such things as British industry, the French feudal system, classical slavery. In my PhD dissertation, which was on Marx's Capital, I spent a lot of time. When Marx refers to feudalism, I ask myself, what did he actually know about feudalism? What were the sources that were available in 1850 on the basis of which he would be able to have some knowledge about feudalism? Likewise about classical slavery. What did he know about classical slavery? What did he know about China? He makes assertions about China and about the imperial system in China. We need to know on the basis of what sources did he come to those conclusions. But here's Marx's basic methodological view, be empirical. Don't just theorize, go out and get empirical knowledge about the processes you're interested in. Secondly, be scientifically critical. Question the assumptions, test the consistency of interpretations, evaluate ideas in terms of their ability to explain the social world. Be critical. In other words, just building a theory is way, way too easy. We can all build theories. The tough part is to empirically evaluate those theories and to really challenge those theories and try to figure out, are they consistent? Are they fully developed? Are there major conceptual problems? And then finally, this is Marx speaking. It's not necessarily, you know, the right thing for Chinese social scientists, but Marx's view was that social science should be directly engaged in the topic of exploitation. It should be concerned about the needs of the underclass. He might say, if he were a more polite German than he was. He was not a particularly polite person, Marx. He tended to curse quite a lot, and he tended to heap abuse on his enemies and his opponents. But if he were to put his point in a polite way, he would say, who is going to be interested in the working class and the underprivileged classes of society if it's not social scientists? If social scientists are not lending their ability to analyze and discover to the interests of the oppressed and the disadvantaged, who else is going to care about them? So his view is that we should allow theory to be a tool for social improvement, to allow theory to reveal underlying conflicts. Now, this is very different from American social science in the 1940s and the 1950s, which tended to be society is a system of unified interests. People are all pretty much advantaged by the same things. Marx's approach to social science basically says there are really deep conflicts of interest in most societies. That's the class point. There are deep conflicts of interest, and social science needs to show what those conflicts are rather than papering them over. The moral ideas, I won't say more about them at the moment, but I believe that there are some moral ideas, and in fact I asked you to read, again, it's something that is one of the assignments, a short essay of mine on the subject of whether there are moral ideas in Marx, whether he has a theory of justice, whether the theory of alienation is in fact a substantive moral theory of human nature, which I actually believe it is. Now, this is the last couple of slides. This is we're just a couple of minutes from the end. What is the relevance of Marxism in the 21st century? I would say American social scientists can ask themselves this question, but I would also think Chinese social scientists could ask themselves this question. What is the relevance of Marx? One is to be critical, that we should test and weigh and criticize Marx's ideas. And this is the highest form of respect. We respect an idea by taking it seriously enough to question it. So questioning Marx's basic assumptions, really trying them out and seeing whether they work or not, that's an important form of respect. Secondly, we should recognize it is a limited perspective. Just as is the perspective of any brilliant, insightful observer of a complex social reality. I'm kind of wondering if right now, today, writing in China, there are any of those really brilliant, one-sided but insightful social writers about China today. I would be very curious to hear what you think about that. Are there some people writing about China today and its process of change, where it's going, what's driving it, that you find really exciting? If so, I'd like to hear about that. Marx's perspective highlights some aspects, overlooks others altogether. An interest in feminism, for example, in the 20th century, we have that interest. Marx did not have that interest. He was not interested in race. He was not interested in class. He was interested in class. He wasn't interested in gender. Not particularly interested, anyway. So it's one-sided, but we can still learn a lot from it. But what is the relevance? Well, it offers us, it kind of points us in the direction of looking at power, exploitation, domination, and alienation. And I would put it forward that these are central threads of my society and your society, but also of Iraqi society and of African society, that these threads of power, exploitation, domination, alienation, these are important threads, and these are things that as sociologists and political scientists we need to understand. Secondly, the idea that social arrangements are flexible. Now that sounds like a positive thing. What I'm really saying is they're flexible in the sense that the powerful can transform them to their benefit. Well, that's what Marx was saying. And so we need to be paying attention to how social institutions and social arrangements are captured and then used as instruments of domination and control. Marx emphasizes the point, and I personally think it's a very relevant point, that great economic systems create groups with substantial economic interests who are in turn positioned to employ instruments of power for their own advantage. That, in other words, economic power leads to the possibility of exercising political power. That's an important insight. It's one that I think we can pay attention to. Emphasis also, this is the more what you might call progressive and hopeful side of Marxism, the idea that there is a basic democracy that comes from the majority of people. The fact that in a mass society, the majority of people, if they can exercise democratic voice, they can do a lot to challenge the power and domination and alienation of society if they are mobilized in the right way, in social democratic ways. So there's an important kind of subtext in Marx, which is that it is possible for the majority of society to have its own power and influence on the basic arrangements of society. And we managed that in 40 minutes, and we did a great job. And I'm really curious what you all think about Marx. And then we'll take another little break, and then we'll come back for the third and final segment. reactions about Marx, rational choice Marxism, the relevance of Marxism? What do you all think? Right. Which is the reason why I was emphasizing criticism, reflection, questioning assumptions. If Marxism, personally, my approach, if Marxism has any relevance at all, it can only be when we've really questioned and really we're open to and we're free to question and to see what is relevant, what is not relevant. That on that basis, there's value. If it's just a catechism, if it's just an application of a sacred text, then it's hard to take it very seriously. That's a good point. Other points? What do you think about the rational choice? I saw you reacting to the idea of rational choice Marxism. Do you think that's a marriage made in heaven? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. You're saying, and my advocacy, which is very easy for me in the United States, is that as Chinese universities are going through a period of important change, that became very apparent to me when the president of my university, Mary Sue Coleman, visited China 2 weeks ago, that some agreements were reached between Peking University and the University of Michigan, which are very important agreements, and they have a lot of language about academic freedom, about the autonomy of faculty, and by implication, autonomy of students to think their own thoughts. The thought that I have is that universities and social science in particular has the opportunity in the next 10 years in China to really move towards that greater degree of academic freedom and an ability to criticize and question openly without punishment. So I would advocate as an outside observer, the social sciences will be much, much richer and more useful if that's true. In other words, it's a reason for the Ministry of Education and for the top administrators to say, yes, we do need, and in fact, I saw the, it's not the Minister of Education, but it is the high cabinet official. I saw a speech that she made which said the universities in China must change. They must become more free, more academically rigorous, more academically free. in other words, it seems to me that there is a process of change underway, and in my own tiny little way, by advocating to you, I'm advocating the value of pressing for criticism, for free expression, for questioning assumptions, and that will lead to better social science. So I encourage you. But I also encourage you to be pragmatic about the examinations and exercise your freedom of thought and expression when you become, a professor. And I don't know if that's good advice. I shouldn't offer advice anyway. It's bad for me to advise. Okay, so we take a break for 10 minutes and then come back for the third segment. It'll also be a little bit shorter, so don't feel too worried that it's too hot in here. We're coming to an end. But the third segment is on global justice. Okay. And that's lecture, I think, 13 in the booklet. Mm-hmm.